The hope at that time was that all of the nations, and especially the major nations, among those that were going through a gigantic effort to win the war, had learned the tragic lesson that only unity among the peace-seeking nations in support of the preservation of peace can make enduring peace a reality for each of them. This basic assumption, however, did not stand alone. There were several other fundamental assumptions involved in the situation. Perhaps the most important of these was that after the war, each of the major nations would maintain sufficient forces of its own to make sure that in the event that some of them were to prove recalcitrant, it and the others that wanted peace would be in a position to make it much too risky for the recalcitrant nations to enter upon the path of aggression and violence. After all, nations like individuals live in peace fundamentally for one of two reasons, either because they want to live in peace or because they think that it is too risky to break the peace. Unfortunately, it was this last vital assumption that was not vindicated in the period immediately following the war. For reasons known only to themselves, the Soviet leaders chose a course of action that led them along the dangerous primrose path only recently trod by the Axis aggressors. At the same time, while Soviet Russia retained much of its wartime military strength, the United States, the other great pinnacle of power in the post-war world, permitted its wartime military establishment to deteriorate out of all proportion to the military strength still retained by the Soviet Union. I believe that the Soviet behavior in recent years, both inside and outside the United Nations, has to an important extent been a reflection of the dangerous disparity of actual military strength that thus became established in the world. I'm convinced that if we had exercised the prudence of not permitting our military strength to disintegrate without regard to what was happening elsewhere in the world, many of our difficulties with the Soviet Union would not have appeared. Be that as it may, the United Nations has so far had to operate in a world overwhelmingly characterized by the situation that I have just described and by more recent efforts to redress the disparity. Under these circumstances, what is surprising to me is not that the United Nations has not been able to achieve more than it has achieved, and I submit that in the light of the brief summary of its activities that I've just described, it has accomplished a good deal, but that it has been able to achieve as much as it has, in spite of all its difficulties, in spite of the deplorable behavior of the Soviet Union. I should like to ask this question. Would the world situation during the past 4 years have been better if the United Nations did not exist? I doubt it. I'm inclined to think that the existence of the United Nations and a new spirit of collective responsibility for the peace and well-being of the world that have been engendered by the agreement on and adherence to the Charter of the United Nations by the overwhelming majority of the nations has stood us in good stead during these perilous and difficult years and will continue to stand it in good stead. Nevertheless, it is quite understandable that public discussion on the United Nations, especially in this country, has been strongly marked by a note of disappointment and disillusionment. This feeling has been strengthened, I think, to a large extent by the fact that there was a general tendency to expect more from the United Nations at the time that it was created than it could possibly deliver. It should have been crystal clear from the start that a new international organization could not be expected to transform overnight the whole system of relations among nations. Unfortunately, emerging as the world was from the Holocaust of a terrible war, there were too many people who were carried away by the idea that the mere establishment of an international organization would perform the miracle of taking care of all our troubles. The truth of the matter was, I think, that by establishing the United Nations, the peace-seeking nations of the world were providing themselves with a new mechanism for the conduct of international relations, but one that was to be supplementary to all the other machinery of international relations, rather than one that would supplant the latter. After all, the United Nations is not something suspended in the air above the nations themselves. The United Nations is the nations that compose it. It can help the nations to raise the standards of their international behavior, but it itself cannot rise above the standards set by the nations themselves. All this, I think, is good logic. But unfortunately, it is not the way things at times happen. There is always, and naturally, a search for simple and direct solutions, no matter how complicated the problems that clamor for solutions. Hence, it is entirely understandable that the existing widespread feeling of disillusionment and frustration has led to a vigorous search for other ways out, and that many proposals have been devised for changing the United Nations system, or, as the current phrase goes, for strengthening the United Nations. That about winds up my lecture number one. Now, if you will bear with me for a few more minutes, I will continue and discuss some of these proposals that I have referred to. One such proposal that has been discussed for some time and has just been given a new prominence is to reorganize the United Nations without the Soviet Union and its satellites. I can well understand the exasperation with Soviet behavior that has prompted this proposal the other day and has prompted it on many occasions before that. Unfortunately, I am afraid that the acceptance of this proposal would constitute a complete retreat from what I like to regard as a great forward movement that came to a climax when the United Nations was established. I see no useful purpose to be served by deliberately releasing the Soviet Union from the obligation that it assumed when it accepted the Charter of the United Nations. And that is what we would be doing if we were to reorganize the United Nations with Russia out of it. I see no useful purpose that could be served by ostracizing the Russian satellite states, those poor, unfortunate countries that are now under Russia's despotic rule and are desperately hoping for freedom from that. If the purpose of such an action as is being proposed is to convert the reorganized United Nations into a military alliance, a coalition against Soviet imperialism, and I certainly have no objection to such a coalition, if for no other reason than to deter the rulers of the Kremlin from further pursuit of their criminal ambitions. If that is the purpose, then there are much more effective ways of doing this within the framework of the existing organization itself. If the purpose is to intensify moral pressure on the Soviet Union, and I'm completely in accord with the idea that the free world needs imperatively to mobilize all of its moral and spiritual forces in opposition to communism and to Soviet imperialism, then I'm convinced that there is no better place or circumstance for doing this than within the present United Nations. Only 5 months ago, a powerful blow was struck, I think, on that score. The General Assembly passed a resolution setting forth all over again the ethical code of behavior which the peace-seeking nations regard as obligatory for all of them. This resolution was adopted by a vote of 53-5 against violent Soviet opposition, but with the Soviet Union present and on the defensive as it never could have been if the resolution had been adopted in its absence. Apart from this proposal, most of the others center around the idea of reforming the present organization. The one that is perhaps oftenest heard of is based on the idea that the abolition, or at least substantial modification of the veto privilege, would sufficiently strengthen the United Nations to make it a really effective instrument for the maintenance of peace and security. You've all heard about it. Let us take a look at what would happen if this were done. Obviously, if no single nation would be in a position to stop by its vote alone any decision by the United Nations, a very important limitation would be to action by the United Nations would be removed. The Security Council would then be in a situation in which, if the requisite majorities could be obtained, it would be able to make any decision involving any one of the nations, large or small, even to the point of using armed force against it. But would that have any reality? The United Nations would still have to be in a position of enforcing its decision. And if the theory is correct, that a major nation can be coerced only by a combination of the forces of the other major nations, this would mean that the United Nations would have to have the authority to call into action, if necessary, all of the forces and resources of the major nations that are not accused of crimes and misdemeanors. Hence, the abolition of the veto would have significance only if this second step were taken. Specifically, so far as we're concerned, if the United States would be willing to permit the United Nations by a majority vote to call into action its armed forces, even at a time when its representatives have voted against the action. Those who advocate the abolition or mitigation of the veto as the solution to all our problems should, I think, first make reasonably certain that the American people are prepared, as I am sure they were not 5 years ago, to accept such an arrangement. So far as I'm concerned, I would far rather take chances on Soviet Russian abuse of the veto than on a voluntary abandonment by us of that necessary safeguard of what I consider, at this time, our vital national interest. Now, the abolition or modification of the veto is obviously very difficult because it requires an amendment to the Charter, and an amendment to the Charter requires, among other things, the concurrence of all the permanent members. So a proposal has been devised to get around the veto by negotiating a supplementary agreement within the framework of the United Nations, under which the nations accepting that agreement would obligate themselves to come to the aid of a country attacked, either when the Security Council under its present procedure determines that an attack has taken place. That is nothing new. But also, if the General Assembly, by a two-thirds vote, including the affirmative votes of three of the five permanent members of the Security Council, would decide that that obligation comes into force and assistance be provided to the country attacked. This proposal involves exactly the same fundamental issue that I have just mentioned in connection with the abolition of the veto. If the United States were to adhere to such a pact, it would have to accept the obligation to use its forces and resources on the decision of other nations, in the event that it happened to be one of the two major nations voting in the negative on the action to be taken.